From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Free trade has taken a beating on the presidential campaign trail this year. Both major party candidates have bashed trade deals. A Duke University and Cato Institute scholar joins us to explain why they're both wrong. North Carolina lawmakers could tweak their funding formula for the state's community colleges. You'll hear highlights from a recent legislative debate on the topic. The state has adopted laws in recent years designed to fight gang activity. You'll learn why some police officers and prosecutors say those laws haven't worked as intended. And you'll learn why a John Locke Foundation expert says voters in one of North Carolina's largest counties should be wary of raising the local sales tax. The goal? Support of a $2 billion transit plan. Those stories are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Perhaps no policy issue is debated more hotly in North Carolina than public education, how we make sure that children are acquiring the skills and the knowledge they need to live productive lives. A new guide to public policy published by the John Locke Foundation offers research-based recommendations to meet that goal. And Dr. Terry Stoops is here to look at some of the key ideas. He is Director of Research and Education Studies for the Locke Foundation, a frequent guest here on our program. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk with one of the most interesting elements of education policy, I think, and that is, how much do we spend and does it matter and should we spend more? Let's start with the basics. How much do we spend?
Well, to operate our public schools, we spend around $12.5 billion, and that number has been increasing over the years and will continue to increase in this coming school year. And that's over $9,000 a student, especially when you add in the amount that we spend on capital expenses, school buildings, and such. So we overall, our spending has been increasing, mostly because of increases in state spending. Our federal spending has been flat or declining over the years, and the local school systems, the local counties have been contributing more over the last 5 years.
That's interesting because some folks may not even realize that funding for students comes from three different places. You've just outlined them. Roughly, Terry, what's the percentage breakdown of the money between federal funds, state funds, and local funds?
Sure. The state funds account for around two-thirds, roughly around 65% of the money for our traditional public school system comes from state sources. Around 25% will come from local sources, county commissions, and around 10% comes from the federal government. So you can see why, for example, there are so many regulations that come down from the state because they control so much of the money. What's unusual about this arrangement is the federal government, because they only contribute 10%, you would think that they wouldn't have much of a say in policy, but they have a great deal of say in policy and contribute a relatively small amount to our public schools.
Now, this area of public school finance is just one piece of the agenda document that has been published. You were a key writer and analyst in the agenda document, which is posted at johnlocke.org. Not only do you talk about how much we spend and where the money comes from, but you make some recommendations. What should North Carolina do going forward in that area?
Well, as far as spending, the one thing we have to remember always when it comes to spending is that there is no relationship or a very weak relationship between how much we spend and how students perform. You will find that across the state, school districts that don't spend a whole lot per student can outperform those who spend quite a bit more than per student. So that's one thing I always like to keep in mind. But I think the most effective way that we can spend money more wisely is for the money to follow the child. We need to make sure that regardless of what kind of school they choose, that that money is always going to follow that student to the school that best meets their needs. And I think that's probably the best way we can ensure that every kid in North Carolina receives the education that they need.
Terry, folks, whether they're parents, taxpayers, educators, not only concerned about issues of money, but the issue of class size has gotten a lot of discussion over the past few years. Tell us where we stand in North Carolina.
Well, our class sizes have stayed pretty much the same as they have in the last 5 or 6 years, years before. Now, one thing to remember is that the General Assembly since 2011 has made a concerted effort to reduce class sizes in grades K through 3. So class sizes in those grades have gone down. The class sizes in the other grades have mostly stayed the same. But as I point out in the document, we shouldn't look too much into this class size issue because we don't find that reducing class sizes by a student or two students does anything to improve student performance. In fact, we would have to go through a period where we invest an enormous amount of money to reducing class sizes by 5 or 6 students for there to be any relationship between the class size and student performance. And that's cost prohibitive.
And that's really fascinating because I think people just in general believe, well, if we just take out 1 or 2 kids, this is going to have some great impact on the achievement of these kids, but evidently not.
No, absolutely not. And if you think about it, if we reduce class sizes radically, we would need to hire many more teachers. We would have to build a lot of school buildings. So the cost is just enormous to reduce class sizes significantly. The approach taken by the General Assembly has been to reduce class sizes in grades where it seems to matter, which is in grades K through 3, and to give school districts the flexibility to create class sizes that best meet their needs in grades 4 through 12.
Well, when we talk about class sizes, of course, that brings us to the discussion of teachers. We have also had quite a hot debate over whether or not teachers are leaving North Carolina, whether it is in greater numbers than other states are experiencing, and why they might be leaving. So are we losing lots and lots of teachers?
We really aren't. If you look at the numbers, import versus export, we are a net importer of teachers. In other words, we have more teachers coming to North Carolina than teachers leaving to teach in other states. A very small percentage of teachers who come to North Carolina decide to go to another state to teach, and that's fine. Some decide to return to their home state to find a teaching position, and that's also fine. One thing we have to remember about teachers coming and going is that we want to recruit great teachers, and we want bad teachers to leave. And the one thing that we need to have a better sense of is, are our best teachers leaving to teach in other states, or these mediocre teachers looking to get out of North Carolina because they can't cut it? I think that's an important recommendation that I have in the piece, is that let's find out who these people are and how they've performed so that we can know whether them leaving is a good thing or a bad thing.
So if poor performing teachers are choosing to leave the system, that's not a problem for us. That's actually a positive.
That's an absolute positive. And, you know, I will show them the door.
Okay. And being that you're a former teacher, I have a feeling you would do that. We've been talking about really traditional public schools here. But of course, North Carolina is very active in the choice movement, giving people options. Are we a national leader in choice, Terry?
We are. And we are a national leader because we have lifted the cap on charter schools. We no longer have a cap on charter schools. So we have around 165 charters, enrolling about 80,000 students, probably more once the final numbers come out. We have thousands of students in our voucher programs. We have a voucher for low-income students and one for special needs students. And the demand for those voucher programs is absolutely immense. And the General Assembly has ensured that those voucher programs are going to remain funded year after year. So this is a significant step. A lot of states aren't willing to give that kind of commitment to our voucher programs, but North Carolina has. And it's really the leadership of the General Assembly and Governor McCrory that has ensured that our voucher programs are going to be funded for years to come.
What's the next step for us in terms of choice and offering parents more ways and more options for how their children are educated?
Well, we need to continue to expand eligibility. Right now, low-income students have access to vouchers. We have to make sure that those middle-income parents have some access to an assistance for a private school for their student if they find that that is what they need. We need to continue to cultivate high-quality charter schools, and we need to ensure that all the schools that these students attend are high-quality institutions that are truly meeting their educational and social needs.
And lastly, Terry, on that issue of high-quality schools and when it relates to public charter schools, the bad ones are shut down, and that has happened.
That's right. We're shutting down the bad ones, and that's why charter school performance continues to increase, because the good ones stay around, the bad ones go away.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He's Director of Research and Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing. Not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Free trade has taken a hit on the campaign trail this year. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and to some extent Hillary Clinton all have had unkind words about the impact of free trade on the American economy. Our next guest offers a different perspective. Scott Linsicum is an international trade attorney. He's also a visiting lecturer at Duke University and an adjunct scholar at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation on Friedman Legacy Day, a day devoted to one of the world's foremost advocates of free trade, the late economist Milton Friedman. Scott, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, free trade. We've been hearing quite a bit more about trade and the impact of trade than we have in recent campaigns. And I see you smiling. The people listening to us can't see the smile, but it's kind of a wry smile that we're hearing probably more for the wrong reasons than you'd want to hear.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're not hearing about free trade because all of the presidential candidates are out there cheering it. Without a doubt, the worst political climate for free trade in the last few decades. And that has demonstrated kind of the collapse of what we call the pro-trade consensus in American politics, at least, in favor of open trade and free trade agreements.
And in fact, if people haven't been following this very closely, you could look back just a couple of decades ago and both major parties supported free trade. Oh, yeah. Now both major parties have major people who have questions or outright concerns or hostility to trade.
Yeah, and it's not even a few decades. I mean, really, the pro-trade consensus goes all the way back to the 1940s. You know, the establishment of the global trading system through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, what we now call the World Trade Organization, was begun by Secretary of State Cordell Hull and as part of the FDR administration. The WTO was created to foment a global stability in the trading system to avoid the kind of trade wars and tit-for-tat protectionism that led to real wars. So, you know, looking back through the last few decades, you saw not just Democrats but also Republicans. President Kennedy was a huge free trader to President Reagan, obviously. And then, of course, lately, both President Bush's, President Bill Clinton, and even President Obama has come around on trade, now supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
Now, with all of the discussion about free trade, what should people know about trade and its impact?
Well, sure. You know, I think the thing that we miss in today's debate is a very simple understanding of what trade really is. political candidates in particular talk about trade as if it is this zero-sum battle between countries. So China is doing this to America and we're losing. You hear that a lot, especially from Donald Trump. We're losing at trade. Well, this actually fundamentally misunderstands what trade is. The fact is that trade is simply a voluntary economic transaction between individuals, not between countries. And it's done on that individual basis. Protectionism, on the other hand, is when the government gets in the way of that transaction. So that can be whether it be between us here in Raleigh and someone in Durham or someone in Washington, D.C. or someone in China. The only thing that changes there is the border you're crossing. And we lose sight of that because instead of talking about this very basic thing that we you know, individuals entering into voluntary, mutually beneficial transactions. We talk about it in terms that are so obfuscating that very simple reality.
We're speaking with Scott Linsicum. He is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, visiting lecturer at Duke University, and an international trade attorney by trade. One of the things that seems to be a problem in the discussion about trade is a move away from the focus on the consumer.
Yeah.
Because when we have free trade, the ultimate beneficiary tends to be the consumer,
right,
doesn't it?
Yeah, dating back to Adam Smith. That's one of the fundamental – it's another fundamental misunderstanding about trade. And this actually really the blame falls on free traders, at least free traders in politics and in the business community. They always have tried to sell trade through a obsessive focus on exports and on opening foreign markets through reciprocal free trade agreements. Well, that paints trade as a zero-sum mercantilist game in which our big corporations are trying to export lots of goods and services to other countries. But like you said, the biggest beneficiaries of trade are consumers. In fact, a recent study showed that about 90% of the consumer gains to trade go not to big multinational corporations, but to poor and middle class consumers. And, you know, again, if you step back and stop talking about the numbers and you think about this, it makes good sense. Poor and middle class consumers have very tight budgets, and they shop at places like Walmart and Target and buy imported goods. So when the price of that good goes down, they have more money, more wealth, really, because they can stretch their budget further. So when you impose protectionist trade barriers and you raise the price of goods, and typically that's the result of lobbying by well-connected industries and their lobbyists in Washington, D.C., the result is higher prices. When those prices go up, who gets hurt the most? Well, again, it's the poor and middle class consumer. These are American families. The other thing that we miss is consumers also mean businesses. You know, about half of everything we import are things used by American manufacturers to produce other goods and remain globally competitive doing so. So when you raise the price of things like steel, well, that means refrigerators and automobiles get more expensive. It also means that those refrigerator producers or auto producers might look to move offshore where they can get cheaper inputs or, of course, better tax or regulatory policy.
You mentioned earlier that for years and years, decades in fact, major players in both major parties saw the benefits of trade. What happened and how do we get back to the right situation?
Well, how we get back is a very difficult thing, but we can really pinpoint how it happened. It started in the late 90s with the Democratic Party. You really saw from the party of Bill Clinton move sharply away from support for free trade. And if you look at the Democratic Party platform, in fact, from about 96 to 2008, it went from supportive of free trade to basically parroting the anti-globalization movement. So they certainly deserve some of the blame, as does President Obama, really. Although he's pushing the TPP today, for his first 6 years or so, the president condoned discrete protectionism, imposed a little bit of it his own through on Chinese tires and other things, and really never expent any political capital defending free trade. It's only been recently. And the president is kind of the guy for that job because he represents the nation as a whole. And so by abdicating that, you saw a vacuum that no one really filled. But then finally, there really needs to be blame placed on pro-trade advocates in Congress and in the business community that failed to kind of to explain the full picture of trade, about the benefits of imports, not just exports, about the morality of trade and the immorality of protectionism. By leaving these things out, they essentially sowed the seeds of their own destruction. You know, trade, I joke, is the only issue I've ever heard of where the good guys, the free traders, essentially not only concede the bad guys' arguments, but actually implicitly support them through their own rhetoric, talking about trade surpluses and export promotion and so forth. So when you do that, it really makes it difficult to win the rhetorical battle.
Well, one person who would be happy to hear a defense of free trade would be the late economist Milton Friedman. We are talking in connection with Friedman Legacy Day. And our speaker has been Scott Linsacombe, who is an international trade attorney, visiting lecturer at Duke, and also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina legislators might tweak their funding formula for state community colleges. Proposals involve more funds for part-time students, greater flexibility, changes in performance-based funding. New Community College System President Jimmy Williamson responded to the ideas.
We believe that we are certainly lean and mean, and we function on 9% of the total budget for the state of North Carolina, for the education budget, and I think we do a pretty effective job. But we certainly are challenged by that 9%. We educate somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 North Carolinians each year on that 9%. And as the economy grows and we are expected to continue to respond to that, we need your help. And but the formula in general, as has been stated, certainly works. We could handle some tweaking. We're never criticized for the product that we put out, other than the fact that there just aren't enough of them, enough employees or enough students coming through our system. And that's an area that we have focused on as well, is trying to generate the or to close this interest gap, where we see jobs and opportunities available in North Carolina.
Senator Fletcher Hartzell offered a proposal.
Can the community college system use a tiered tuition system?
The actions that have been taken to date have established a standard tuition rate that we charge currently $76 per credit hour, regardless of the curriculum course and regardless of the institution.
That's Community College Chief of Staff Jennifer Haygood. Another state senator, Ralph Hies, addressed the idea of differential tuition.
One of the challenges in a tiered or changing the tuition rate is it does nothing to help the campuses. Tuition funds go into one pool, and the campuses are only paid on the basis of FTEs.
Haygood also offered a suggestion.
You would want to do it in such a way to be able to make, to easily be able to explain to students why there are different rates for different courses. I would advise against thinking that you would charge differential rates based on program versus courses, simply because you may have a student who is in a associate in applied science degree program in a technical field, but part of the degree requirements might be an English class, for instance. It would not be practically feasible for us to be able to charge a different rate to the certain students in the English class versus other students in the English class, because we do charge based on the credit hours of an individual course.
You've been listening to debate about possible tweaks to North Carolina's community college funding formula. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are taking a look at the way North Carolina prosecutes gang activity. They're getting help from people like Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman.
There is no one solution. And people who tackle and deal with this problem day to day, they will tell you that any real effort to combat the gang problem in North Carolina has got to be a multi-approach effort.
North Carolina has a Gang Suppression Act. It hasn't been used very often, but Freeman says there's more to the story than just the numbers.
Anyone who is in law enforcement or the DA's office in Wake County will tell you that we have a gang problem. Having said that, we had over the last 3 years a total of 12 charges brought under the Gang Suppression Act. 3 years, 12 charges. All of those ultimately were dismissed. I went back and pulled the cases for this particular past year. Of those defendants who were charged, two of the individuals actually were convicted of common law robbery, which is a Class G felony, whereas the offense for which they had been charged under the gang statute was a Class H felony. And many of y'all have been at this long enough, and I'm not going to belabor this point very long, but you know that our felonies are ranked A through I, with I being the least serious in terms of punishment, time you can get, that sorts of things, and all the way up to A, first-degree murder. And so what we see in many of these cases is that the real offense for which someone is being prosecuted, whether it is armed robbery, common law robbery, shooting into occupied property, is often much higher than these underlying gang offenses are currently listed or currently approved by the legislature to be. And so I think when you come down to a plea negotiation, often those are the charges that fall out.
It's not just the level of punishment linked to the crime. Freeman says it's hard to prove gang activity.
When you think about why a prosecutor might offer a plea offer in any case and why we might not move forward with a particular charge, there are a number of issues you have to think about. One is, how do we prove a case? And folks, I will tell you that being on the front lines of this issue, often that is one of the most difficult challenges. We see regularly people going to prison for lengthy sentences when they have been given an opportunity to provide information about a co-defendant or information to law enforcement about other more serious cases that they are investigating, and they don't want to risk being killed or damaged or their family coming under threat from a fellow gang member. And so I think that's something that, you know, from the front lines, it's important for this body to kind of be aware of, that a lot of these cases, in order to prove that they've been done as some pattern of gang activity, or, for example, that someone has been solicited to become a member of a gang, require somebody to be willing to come into court and to testify about that transaction. And, you know, we live currently under a state law system where, unlike the federal system, we really have no protection, no witness protection program.
Along with the Wake County District Attorney, lawmakers also heard from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Detective Chuck Hastings. He identified several key problems in fighting gang activity. The first involves what he calls intelligence and documentation.
Throughout North Carolina, departments are getting away from having gang units or intelligence units. Why use manpower in documenting gang members and or groups? And it's obvious to everyone in this room, but it is very time intensive, to document gang members for several reasons. One, they're getting smarter. They're learning from us in law enforcement how we're documenting them and their actions, and they're learning from court and maybe some of their great defense attorneys on what to do and what not to do. Number two, we're not really prosecuting the gang laws. Gangs are changing every day. North Carolina has a lot more than just Bloods, Crips, Kings, MS-13, Serrano 13, some of the Hispanic gangs that you might see on TV. We have a lot of hybrid-type gangs.
Along with the decline in information about gangs, law enforcement agencies worry about the safety of crime victims and witnesses.
There's no funding. I had the privilege of working in the federal system for 10 years on a federal task force. The feds have this thing called EWAP. It's not federal relocation. It's a fund of sorts that would allow them to relocate a victim or witness and their entire family, if need be, to have the goal of them not being intimidated. Witness intimidation statute, in my opinion and law enforcement's opinion, needs to be extended. My opinion is from the very first time they're arrested to the end of their prison or probation term, to encompass that entire area which they could be intimidated. In most cases, some people think intimidation can only happen in person. I want you to think about, in many cases, victims and witnesses are intimidated by phone calls. Social media is big nowadays.
Another key problem for Hastings, a change in the concept known as snitching.
Back when I was young, the term snitching was, if I'm in one group and I get shot at by a separate group, I would have no problem in telling law enforcement who shot at me. That would be no problem. Today's form of snitching is I will not tell on the rival group even for shooting at me. They call that snitching now. So it's coming to a big problem for law enforcement, getting anybody to cooperate. I've had gang members come up to me and tell me, hey, just so you know, blank shot at me last night. I was standing in my front yard. It went through my house and almost hit my kid. All right, well, let's do a report. Nope, we're not putting anything on what they refer to as black and white. We're not putting anything on paper. I just want to let you know. What kind of predicament are we putting law enforcement in? In my opinion, he's trying to set himself up for something retaliatory. We have to go through that, and we have to continue to work through those issues.
One final problem Hastings cited, a lack of cooperation.
They know if they talk to law enforcement, everything's going to be documented somewhere. It's going to be either on recording or they're going to write it. We're going to write it down in the computer, and it's going to be released in discovery. They call that as black and white. You'll see it on social media. Most gang members will make sure they have something on black and white before they retaliate against another member or somebody that's snitching on somebody. All information is released. Most cases in most counties around the state that I've heard through our members of the gang association is almost immediate after an indictment, they're sending out every piece of discovery, non-redacted. That's including names, emails, addresses, phone numbers, and statements, which is a serious issue. And then no state-based witness relocation or witness protection program of any kind. And what benefits do we have of that is, you know, we have no benefit for anybody, whether it be another gang member or a citizen, to cooperate in our state system when it comes to gangs.
You've been listening to key pieces from a recent state legislative meeting highlighting the challenges linked to fighting gang activity. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina is a very fast-growing state and one of the largest in population as well. Now, from the mountains to the coast, metropolitan areas are now looking at issues like transportation and education as more and more people are moving in. In fact, on November 8th, voters in a number of North Carolina counties will vote on these types of issues, with Wake County getting a whole lot of attention for the issue its voters will decide. Julie Tisdale is the John Locke Foundation City and County Policy Analyst. She joins me now with a look at one of these key local issues. Julie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So we know that we've got a long ballot for November 8th. You got president, governor, all sorts of statewide races, but these local ballot issues too, and you've been looking at them. Give us a sense of how widespread the local ballot issues are and what they're about.
It is a really long ballot. I printed mine this morning. It's almost two full pages. I've got 40 different things I'm voting on.
So take your lunch into
That's
the polling
right.
place.
That's right. Print your ballot early and do some research. But across the state, there are 14 counties that are looking at increases in sales tax. There are 11 local governments that are voting that are looking at bonds issues. And then 15 counties or municipalities are looking at referenda concerning alcohol. There are a couple of other little things about how county commissioner boards are set up or those sorts of things, but those are the big three categories that lots of voters are considering.
So the big one is potential sales tax increases. Why is that? And are they saying what they're about? Are they education specific, many of them?
They're different. Some of them may be education, but it's different in each locality. A few years ago, the General Assembly passed some legislation that allows counties to implement a quarter cent increase in the sales tax. Any county can do that. And so in the years since, we've seen lots of counties vote on these sorts of measures. They often don't pass. Voters are very reluctant to allow these kinds of sales tax increases, and rightly so.
And we've seen a number of counties actually over the past few years come back a second or even a third time, put it on the ballot again, and some would say kind of trying to wear down their voters, so to speak.
That's exactly how I would describe it. And we have seen that often, which I think is a little discouraging. If the voters say no, we probably ought to pay attention to that.
Now, in Wake County, you've been looking at this specifically because Wake is one of the counties with a sales tax increase that's on the ballot. Voters will say yes or no to this item. What does Wake County want to do?
Wake County wants to actually do a half-cent sales tax increase, so it's a large one, and they want to use that to fund a transit plan that they've come up with that was published, I think, in June, maybe a little earlier, that would cover a whole gamut of transportation options for people. The big three sort of components are commuter rail, bus rapid transit, and then just an expansion of the regular bus service that we have already.
Our listeners may recall, Julie, that we have talked over the years on this program about Wake County, and Charlotte was involved in this, and I believe the Triad at one point had some sort of a proposal that was involving light rail. Is light rail a part of this at all?
Thankfully, no. Light rail has been considered, and one of the things that Wake County commissioners, I really commend them for, is that they have rejected that. They've looked at it and said, this just really doesn't fit our population. And I think they're right about that. Durham and Orange counties are continuing with it. But it was a pretty big blow when Wake County said no, because that makes more sense if you've got the whole sort of area doing it together. This does have commuter rail.
What's
the difference there is actually pretty simple. Light rail requires its own track. It's a different size of track than Amtrak uses. So you have to build new lines. Now, the advantage of that is that you don't have anybody else on those lines. So it's more reliable. It's quicker. You don't have any kind of traffic. The commuter rail that Wake County is considering uses the same existing tracks as Amtrak and freight services. The big advantage there is that obviously it costs less if you're not having to put in that infrastructure. Trains are still expensive, but you don't have the added cost of the track. The disadvantage is that you're having to deal with all this other traffic on the line. So it's not as reliable. It's not as quick. You can get, the Amtrak holding things up or whatever. There's all that potential.
So what is the role of this tax increase in funding this recommended plan? Because, again, voters in Wake County are going to vote yes or no on this half-cent sales tax on November 8th. So what role is it in the whole plan?
Over the next 10 years, it would be 36% of the funding. It is the largest single source of funding for the plan.
Fair to say that if the voters choose not to approve this, does the plan go away? They have to go back to the drawing board?
They do. They do. There's not a plan B for other funding if this tax doesn't pass. And because it's such a significant chunk, I mean, it is the largest single source of funding. So if that goes away, they will have to go back to the drawing board and either come up with completely different funding options, which it seems difficult to see how they would be able to do that, or to change the plan so that it is less expensive, not quite as comprehensive or something. But they will have to go back to the drawing board.
One would think that in a plan like this, that there should be some revenue coming in from people who are actually hopping on the bus rapid transit or the commuter rail. What role does actually user fees play in
you
this?
Would think, but surprisingly, only 4% of the funding is supposed to come from user fees. Now, that's 4% of the total funding. But even if we just look at the operating cost and none of the capital, Only about 20% of the operating funding will ever be expected to come from user fees.
Now, you have taken a look at this entire plan. You've analyzed it, looked at the costs. You've looked at ridership patterns and of the existing system and all that. And essentially, you've concluded that it's probably not a good fit. Tell us why.
There is just no evidence that people in Wake County really want to use these kinds of transit systems. So we see a demonstrated preference for cars, and that's because we're not super dense. If we were New York City or Washington, D.C., and we had a really, really dense core, then it might be different. But we're so spread out that people prefer to ride cars. They're more convenient. You can go from home to work and swing by and pick up the kids or get dinner or whatever on the way in a way that you just can't with buses and trains. And people still like that in Wake County. So we see that that's where people are choosing, how people are choosing to get around. We have an existing bus network that people don't use very much. It's used a little bit. I'm not suggesting we get rid of it, but there doesn't seem to be any – there's not heavy use of that. So there doesn't seem to be any demand for a lot more of it.
Why then a recommendation for such a plan?
Well, that's a question that I've asked a lot. It really looks like they kind of – they're concerned about image, that this is what – progressive, up-and-coming, trendy cities do is they have all of this kind of public transportation. They talk a lot about building this whole system and that if they build it, people will then use it. They'll change their travel patterns. But they don't offer any evidence that that's the case. And I'm highly skeptical of that goal. I think that people have demonstrated what they want. They want to drive their cars, and this plan doesn't allow them to do that.
Well, we've been talking with Julie Tisdale about Wake County's recommended transit plan, a plan that she says is really a plan to nowhere. Wake County voters will give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to the half-cent sales tax increase that will be part of this plan. That will be on their November 8th ballot. You can read Julie's report on this at johnlock.org. Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.